All right.
Okay. Be professional this time, Alex.
Professionalism is my goal. Okay. Yes.
On topic. We're going to keep it on topic. we're reading Sepp Holzer's Permaculture. We're on chapter 4. This is chapter 4, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And in the last podcast of this book, we talked about growing mushrooms, and it was like the stuff that you could easily grow yourself. Now this time we're going to talk about growing those same mushrooms on straw instead of logs.
Right.
And we're going to talk about cultivating wild mushrooms, so stuff that is not the simple stuff.
Right.
Although, you know, I didn't see anything in here about morels, which is kind of, I mean, like, I, like, double-checked and triple-checked, like, where's the morels? So I guess you're just boned with morels, although I've got some ideas on things I might try. But,
I wonder if he has a lot of morels over there. Who knows? I mean, is it...
Yeah. Maybe if he brought morels over there, they'd be like this invasive species out of control. But wouldn't that be kind of awesome?
Yeah, that's right. Give me that. Invasive food.
Yeah. But of course.
I can't take on food.
Look at the blackberries. Look how invasive blackberries are. Mm-hmm. Where you are and in the Puget Sound area and probably in a lot of other places. And they are really delicious.
They really are good.
But they're also really thorny.
They are, but, you know, you can put them around the perimeter, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, they are awesome. They make great wildlife habitat and everything.
Eat your fence, yeah.
I didn't mark up too much of this stuff about growing it in bales. Basically, it's like, you know, these other techniques we've already talked about. But the thing is that you want to start with a very clean straw that isn't rotted at all. And then start to introduce stuff, because if it's starting to break down at all, then that means some other fungus has already moved in, and you're not going to be able to get anything to move in.
Right.
I've marked off this part. Small compressed straw bales are the easiest to work with because they can still be transported easily when they are wet. For me, it is essential that the straw comes from organic farms. Conventionally grown straw is not suitable, as far as I am concerned, because it might have been treated with or contaminated with herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, and we're trying to grow fungus here.
Right.
Chemical fertilizers and other chemicals such as growth regulators. For this reason, you should use straw that has been organically grown. So then, this reminds me of something where I was, so Sepp was in the United States, and I was there, and this guy was setting up an event, and they brought in a bunch of straw bales, and are going to do all this stuff. And so Sepp's standing, and there's like, I don't know, there's like 50 people there, and Sepp's standing in front of him, and he's, you know, telling him this, that, and the other thing. And so I go to the guy that kind of put the event together, who bought the straw, and I said, "Is that organic straw?" And then his eyes went wide, and he said, "Oh, fuck, I forgot about that."
Wow.
And then it's like, once I said it, then the guy that was putting the event on, he realized what I was asking, and that is that, you know, because most straw, like anything that's raised conventionally, they almost, you know, it's like the general rule of thumb that they hose the land down with persistent herbicides, and then the grain plant takes it up. And so now the persistent herbicide is inside the plant. And then you come along and you harvest the grain, and then you harvest the straw. And the straw is loaded with these persistent herbicides. And then if you take this straw with the persistent herbicides, and then you go and you put it on your garden or whatever, it kills everything but the grasses. And so this is such a rampant problem and such a common problem that, you know, people that are familiar with it, most, you know, are like always making sure that any straw that they use on their gardens is going to be organic, because, you know, straw is always going to come from a grass. It's like an industrial waste from a grain crop.
And what is the straw generally used for? I mean, is it for feeding animals? What do they do with a straw?
No, with straw is never fed animals. Although, if you see animals actually eating the straw, that's indicative of like you are not raising them well.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha. But I mean, did they use it for like say for mulching, like what we're generally using it for?
Usually, people use it for bedding for animals because it's a high carbon, right?
Okay.
It's very high carbon, and so then like if you put it in a barn and then the animals come and they poop on it,
right?
Well then. Your carbon to nitrogen ratio is better, and then you can have like you know proper composting and breaking down. Plus, it's like it reduces the odors, it reduces the mess, and so it's just cleaner, better for the animal. That's how straw is usually used in ag, and to differentiate between animals eating it and not eating it. As the grass grows, if I cut it when it's green and dry it, that's hay. And that's food. That's something that for a lot of animals to eat.
Right.
But then if I wait until the plant puts out its seeds and then it turns brown, you know, yellow, and then it's like all dried up, and then you come along and you harvest the seeds and you leave the – and then the straw that's left behind is the exact same plant, but now it's all dried up and dead and it's no longer green. And that's not food.
Right.
So that's really the difference. And then, you know, when we're talking about using these things as mulches in a garden, some people say, oh, use straw, but don't use hay because of the seeds. And it's like, no, they both contain the seeds. They're both – it's just different stages of life. In fact, some straws will have more seeds in it than the hay.
Actually, in our area, I noticed the straw has all the seeds that will grow and very little seeds in the hay, which is weird.
No, it should be. I mean, it's going to be random. It's going to be random.
Okay, well, good. All right.
Yeah.
Makes more sense to me.
It depends on so many different little factors.
Right.
So, you know, but the key is okay. So what we're talking about here is make sure that the straw that you use, if you're going to raise mushrooms in it, make sure. In fact, if you bring anything onto your land, and really, I think with permaculture, I think a lot of the stuff that we're going to be shooting for is we want to get to the point that we're not importing anything.
Agreed.
You know, and maybe even someday we'll get to the point where we're not even importing seeds.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And at the beginning, you might be importing some organic matter, and you might – but then when you do that, you just really want to be careful that it doesn't contain any persistent herbicides or any kind of toxic gick.
Well, this is why I was trying to figure it out. See, I buy it from a feed place that's also a nursery. So my question is, if it's got all this junk in it, are we supposed to be feeding it to animals and or putting our plants under it? So I wasn't really sure why – you know, because I will tell you, we used to use pine straw when I first got started in this. And where it probably adds a little bit of acid to the soil, and we're already acidic down here, I got away from it. But things were growing really well, and the sun could not tear this stuff apart. It's very strong. then I switched to hay, and it's as if things don't grow as well with it. So I'm starting to wonder if maybe there is some kind of herbicide in there or something.
Wow. I mean, the things that you just said, I've got like 4 hours of responses.
Gotcha.
You know,
another podcast.
It's a really rich, rich area, and I think that the bottom line is you're going to be happier, I believe, if you can get to the point where you're not bringing any organic matter onto your farm.
Right.
And so much of the videos I've been doing, like, you know, the ones I did with Norris and Tulsi and Helen Attow, is where they're talking about how much food that they can grow per acre without bringing in organic inputs. I mean, that was a big part of it, because eventually you get to the point where it's like so much of the organic matter that's offered to you, even from a nursery, which should know better.
Right.
Will contain problematic stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, the nursery is going to sell you compost, and it's not like a homemade compost. It's a commercial scale compost, and nearly all commercial scale composts contain persistent herbicides. And what the nursery is trying to do is basically, this is an industrial waste stream that they've picked up for cheap, and then they're marketing it up and selling it. And basically, are they in the job of making your garden awesome, or are they in the job of making money for themselves, whether you buy awesomeness or not?
Right, right.
So, you know, basically, If they were to try and sell you stuff that was, you know, free of any kind of persistent herbicide, then they're going to be paying big bank for that, and most of their customers aren't going to be able to tell the difference between the stuff that costs, you know, twice as much as the other stuff, you know. So
right. One of the ways I usually put it is I say, if you're buying it from a nursery, you are buying something that is going to have you coming back, because it's all about getting you back in there and spending that money. So, you know, you buy these plants that need all kinds of inputs because they're already weak. We've learned that in the book. You know, you buy the stuff that says miracle on it, and it's basically killing your plants slowly over yeah. time, you know. So there you go. And anything you buy is already potentially a problem.
Oh, wow. You know, not necessarily a bad rule of thumb, but it just seems like it's 100 times more complicated than that, even.
Right.
So I have to admit that I don't find myself going to a nursery very often.
Right.
I find myself, for whatever seeds I buy and other stuff, I tend to be buying that through the internet, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. And then I also find that sometimes I'll find a nursery-ish place where it's like, they are just bonkers about organic, and then they do have bales of straw for sale, whereas like a lot of regular nurseries, they don't have bales of straw for sale. But then the places that are organic, crazy about organic, they'll have bales of straw for sale, and there'll be bales of organic straw.
That would be amazing.
Verified, certified, definitely, absolutely organic straw. And so the, but I mean, they'll sell it for $10 a bale, which is just insane.
Right.
But still, it's like, you know, if you're in town, it's like, oh, well, I'm going to drive an hour and a half out in the country and buy a bale for $4 a bale.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, and I would pay it, honestly, to have that, to know it. And we don't have that around here. If I ask for something organic, they laugh or they start getting weird. You know, it's strange. So
yeah.
To find someplace that knew what I was even talking about, had it, and was bonkers about it, then heck yeah, I would support them to death.
All right, the next part I got marked up here is, often people well-meaningly overwater mushrooms. Although the mycelium requires moisture, it is still susceptible to ongoing dampness. If the bales are going to be left outside exposed to the elements, they can be covered during heavy or long periods of rain. I leave all my straw cultures outside throughout the year, however, without any additional protection against the weather. The bales can, of course, be covered with brushwood to offer protection over the winter months. I just kind of thought that was something I had never really thought about.
I like
things being too wet for mushrooms.
Right.
Wow. Ooh.
It seems the level of wetness that humidity brings is what they want, not even damp.
Well, or you know, some rains.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but I mean,
yeah.
You know, as in a constant state, you know, like on an ongoing basis, they want to just be humid.
Yeah, yeah. But I would imagine that, you know, that's still not going to be enough. A little bit of rain once in a while is probably going to be required above and beyond the humid.
Sure, and that's natural. I mean, yeah. You know, if it's sitting out in the woods, that's what it's going to get, right? So
yeah,
yeah.
The yields usually occur in phases, provided that the humidity and temperature levels are high enough for the type of mushroom in question. For this reason, the culture's yield depends not only on the size of the substrate, but also on environmental factors. Straw cultures have a lifespan of between 1 and 2 years. Afterwards, the bales are worn out and can be used as fertilizer or mulch. So that's the only parts I really marked about the raising it in straw bales instead of on logs. I don't know. It could work. It's all right. It's a way. And the, you know, the whole chapter kind of goes into a lot of details about raising mushrooms that I skipped over, because it's like, I'm not going to read the whole damn book. Oh, yeah, we should remind people, go buy the book!
Right.
See, permaculture.co.uk and chelseagreen.com, and that's spelled chelseagreen.com. And I I think that they should be available at Amazon. I think they're, you know, both of them available at Amazon.
Right.
The next section is cultivating wild mushrooms, which I think is probably the most profound part of this chapter. And, well, okay, I'm going to read the first section. Some of these things gave me ideas that he didn't put in here, things that I've not tried myself. But this is really profound. These mushrooms live in symbiosis with forest trees. In order to cultivate them, you must provide them with the correct location and symbiotic partner. On the Kramerhof, this always occurs in a mixed culture because the various tree species complement each other not only from an ecological point of view but also in terms of mushroom cultivation. So I think the next part goes into this too. There are many factors that are responsible for a successful culture. Fulfilling them requires a very close observation of natural cycles. This means that cultivating these mushrooms is still not commercially viable to this day. So I'm going to guess that there's going to be some places that will grow certain mushrooms and some places that don't. In fact, I'm going to guess that there's some places that grow these mushrooms and most places that don't.
Right.
So what you're going to do is you're going to have to observe. Mm-hmm. And when you see the mushrooms occurring naturally in a spot, then you've got to try and observe, okay, what seems to be the companion wood that's growing with this mushroom? And are there any other species in this area? But when I read this, I kind of got the thought of, like, you know what might be kind of a cool thing is to stick a shovel into the soil where the mushroom is, and then you get a great big chunk of soil that contains the mycelium and the fruiting body of the mushroom, and it's the fruiting body of the mushroom in its early stages, and then try and see if you've got other points on your property that might have a similar kind of thing going on, like similar tree, similar understory. You know, like the stuff is kind of the same, and then just transplant that shovel full of soil in this new spot. I wonder if it might take.
You know, if you did it 10 times and you only got one, you'd figure something out.
Right, you'd be on the path.
Right.
You know, like something, if it worked one time, something, it's possible. You've shown that it's possible. Now you got to figure out how you botched it the other nine times.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. You might learn more from the other nine. That's true.
Yeah. I'd like to explain my method of cultivating wild mushrooms using birch bolets. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly. As an example, first I create the correct growing environment. To do this, I might plant young birch trees on a terrace. Afterwards, I introduce the mycelium into the soil between the young trees. And I'm not quite sure, so maybe he got shovelfuls of the soil.
Hmm.
And that's his mycelium sample that he's transplanting. Or I'm not sure what he's doing there when he says that he's introducing the mycelium.
Yep.
Another very good way to propagate mushrooms, in this case wild mushrooms, is to collect ripe fruiting bodies with ripe spores and to put them in a loose weave bag, jute or onion bag. The bag can then be hung up to dry. It's important that it hangs in a well-ventilated area so that it can dry out properly. Once the mushrooms have dried out, I walk around the area, striking the bag lightly with a stick. So I imagine what he's doing is he takes the bag down after it's dried, and he's got a stick, and he walks around whacking the bag with the stick, thus knocking the spores out in the area that he thinks that they might do well. I don't know, that just seems to me like whoa.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've never heard any of this, for sure.
Now, yeah,
I'm sorry. Well, he does explain how he gets some of the forest soil and sawdust soaked in liquid manure. And that's how he is propagating that particular, you know, his birch bolets, if that's pronounced correctly. And then on this one, running around with the bag, and beating the spores out of it, definitely is like broadcast seeding.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Only you know, of course, it probably seems like it'd be good to do it on a moister day. Hopefully it would stick better or something. Well, I guess it doesn't even have to be that. Just any day would work. Because if it's a dry day, it'll just sit there and wait until moisture comes along.
Right.
It'll be dormant.
Like a seed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Wow. Now I just really want to go try this.
Yeah.
All right. The last part I've got marked off is, in the media, a method of harvesting mushrooms is being recommended. That, in my opinion, is completely wrong.
Of course.
Catastrophe!
Yeah.
According to this method, the mushrooms should be cut, the stem removed, cleaned, and the remaining parts of the mushroom should be left behind. On my tours and at my lectures, people regularly ask if this is the best method. In response, I must explain some basic facts about harvesting mushrooms. We gather and eat the unripe fruiting bodies of fungi because the ripe ones are inedible. So, because of this false information from the media, the unripe mushrooms are cut, and the rest of the mushroom is left there to rot. The mold spreads very easily in the areas of the fungus damaged by harvesting. Within 1 to 2 years, the entire mycelium is contaminated and damaged, and the mushrooms disappear. All right. So, what does a ripe mushroom look like?
You know, I don't know.
maybe it looks like mushroom jerky sitting out there, and that's the ripe one.
Right.
So I know that when a mushroom is like, you know, it's getting that little bell head on it.
Right.
And it's getting started, then it's young, and that's when we usually eat it. And then later it kind of opens up more like an umbrella, a fully open umbrella. And then it has all those gills underneath. And then I think it gets a little older still. And then it might even be an umbrella turned kind of inside out. And then it kind of starts to wither, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all of that is sort of like, you know, fish gills, all that stuff. And it's very delicate. And I worry about, when it's ripe, I would imagine it needs to feel squishy. Or not ripe, but unripe, you know, like sprouts. It needs to be fresh and squishy and juicy. And then later on, it's probably going to end up drying out and being harder. But I don't really know.
Yeah, yeah, so...
this will be a good question to ask Sep when you see him.
Sure. Maybe so, or maybe if I ask him, then he will think so little of me that he'll never talk to me again.
Oh, well, that is something to worry about.
I mean, I am beginning to think that there are people out there that have a lot more experience raising mushrooms and fooling with mushrooms than you and I combined.
Sure.
Yeah, and so now I'm feeling like inexperienced shame, like, why do people even listen to my podcast? I'm a doofus. I have no fucking idea what I'm talking about.
Right. Well, that way they can sit around and say, you guys are doofuses, and they can go on and be better people.
maybe.
Right. I'm going to show them.
I mean, okay. So I've raised some mushrooms successfully, but I haven't like put very much time into it, and it's not like a great passion of mine. But I do, I mean, by reading this, I feel like I just learned a whole bunch more stuff that I didn't already know, and I am really excited about it. But yeah, really, you know, I'm now curious about the fruiting body of the mushroom being ripe versus unripe. And it does make sense, though, that the stuff that we harvest, that's like, ooh, that looks tasty, I want some of that. That stuff is the unripe fruiting body. That does make sense. I get that.
Right. So, well, you know, usually when a mushroom looks like the kind of mushroom that you buy in the store, that's when you think it's edible. But there may be something more to it. I have no idea.
I've met, and so this is something that I feel I'm not sure I should share, but I'm going to share it anyway, and we'll just let the chips fall where they may. I've met some people that have that were super knowledgeable and super experienced in the world of mushrooms, and they say that they would never. I mean, first of all, any mushrooms you eat are cooked. This person, I'm gonna focus on one individual for a moment. I've heard it from multiple people, the same story from, I'm gonna tell a couple different things, and I've heard all these things multiple times, but I've got one guy in my head right now, and this guy said, A, he would never eat mushrooms that were not cooked. So that's an interesting thing to keep in mind. And at the same time, he would never eat a button mushroom.
Wow. That's like mostly what's in the grocery stores.
Yeah. And he said something about, like, one time a mushroom expert wrote about this in some kind of detail, like in a peer-reviewed journal or something like that. And then that guy disappeared a few days later, and no one's ever heard from him since. And
maybe you shouldn't talk about it then.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with that. And apparently there's this massive industry of these button mushrooms, which are managed by some very lovely and nice and charming Italian people.
Wow. Okay.
And so then there's this theory going around that maybe some of these Italian people are more charming than others, and they may have felt that their industry was threatened.
Right.
And now I've heard this from many, many sources, and that's why you won't find any more articles suggesting anything that, you know, suggesting the mushrooms are anything less than awesome.
Well, Sepp is advocating in here raw or dried, and that's it.
Huh. Okay. Sepp's traveling a different path.
Right.
Which is awesome, you know. And at the same time, I just kind of thought that I would share this one little tidbit of information, and people can make their own choices about what to make of it. Maybe that guy was a crazy lunatic. And maybe his theories about what happened were errant.
Well, I've noticed that Sepp has conveniently left button mushrooms out of the book.
He doesn't say anything about it.
Oh, no, he's keeping away from that.
That's true. He doesn't say, here's how to grow those. There's no information about that at all.
That's right.
Good point.
Curiously missing.
Yeah. So maybe he's smarter than I am.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oops. All right. Hey.
When the glowing...
And on that note, I think we're done.
When the glowing red dot appears on your forehead, duck.
How do you know there's a glowing red dot on your forehead?
Yeah, well, hopefully someone will tell you.
Yeah. Dude, there's something on your forehead. You just got to kind of wipe like this. Yeah. You know?
Jump.
Yeah.
He hates the oil. He hates... Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else to say about that? I mean, wild mushrooms. I just think that was a lot of really profound stuff. And
I've been told so many times that wild mushrooms are just too scary. So unless you know what you're doing, and even those people who know what they're doing have a problem with them sometimes. So, So I don't know. I'd like to know about it, but I wouldn't personally be eating them.
Morels are pretty safe. So morels are very common in this area. And the thing is, there is a false morel, which they say don't eat. And I've talked to people that have eaten the false morel, and they say, okay, first of all, it's like they could make, if you ate enough of them, it could make you sick, but I don't think it'll kill you. The other thing is that when you eat them, the analogy that they use is that the flavor is like you're eating rocket fuel.
Oh, God. Nice. You know?
So as opposed to morels, true morels, which are like awesomely delicious, but it's like there is a way to be able to tell the difference between the false morel and the true morel. The true morel, it's kind of connected to the stem. The false morel is not. So
interesting.
That's the big thing to tell. But I remember one time I went to go visit my cousin a couple years ago, and I was at his house doing some stuff, and he was like, I'm going to go out and see if I can get some morels. And he came back like an hour later with two grocery sacks full.
Wow. So hopefully they were all real morels.
Oh, they were all real morels. Okay. Yeah, because he knows.
Okay.
And ate Morel's breakfast, lunch, and dinner for a long time. It was really, that was some mighty fine living. I mean, I guess it's kind of like going to Maine and having lobster breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right.
You know? And it costs you pretty much nothing because, you know, oh, I put the strap out and it filled up with 47 lobsters.
Yeah.
So, but this is also in Eastern Oregon where it's like the it's morel country. And it's I know that like every year, like somebody dies because there's all this competitive morel stuff because they pay like major dollars per pound for morels.
And you say somebody dies, you mean as in nefarious means or?
Yeah. Like gunfights break out.
Whoa.
In the wilderness. And there are disputes over, like, this is my morel patch, you know, and you're out in the middle of, like, the wilderness.
And,
that's not yours. That belongs to everybody. My gun says you are wrong.
Yeah, right. Oh boy!
And watch, see those little holes popping up on you. Those little holes are saying you are wrong. And well, I guess I mistaken, I suppose.
Yeah.
So
it's amazing what people will do for mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, morels are really amazingly delicious. I suppose that there are people listening to this podcast right now that have never tasted a morel mushroom.
Oh, that's me. Yeah.
Yeah, they are different and they are really good. And I just kind of have this thing in my head now of a cast iron skillet with butter in it and morels and eggs, and it's just kind of like man, they're good. And and yet, you know, and yet here I am in Montana, and we have a lot of them growing here in Montana. And so that's one of the reasons why I live here, because we got morels and you don't.
Oh, wow, that is the truth. We have oyster mushrooms.
Oh, yeah, those are all right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
They're a delicacy, yay.
All right, Alex, anything else for this podcast?
Nope, nothing yet.
All right. Well, you want to do the sign-off?
Sure. Let's see here. How does this go? So if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about morels, mushrooms, Sepulzer, the glorious, the mighty, all hail Sepulzer, and permaculture all the time.